Chapter 11. Into the Fishbowl. Spring 2003. "So we thought it would be fun if Nick took you camping," the woman said in my living room. This was a production assistant whose name I can't remember. There were so many people in and out of our house that in the beginning we lost track of who was who. "Nick wants to go camping?" I asked. My husband was not someone who randomly planned adventures. If we weren't working, we were on the couch, or trying to figure out how exactly we were going to pay the mortgage on our million-dollar house in Calabasas. "It would be funny," she said. "Fun." "Where?" I asked. "Like, where do you even go camping in L.A.? Santa Barbara?"
"Yosemite."
I had no idea where Yosemite was, and I swear I had it confused with Jellystone. "Like with Yogi Bear?" I asked. "Are there bears there?"
"Oh, that's good," she said. "You should be worried about that. We can use that."
Welcome to the filming of season one of Newlyweds Nick and Jessica, and the first year of my marriage. Places, everyone. When I packed for the trip, I stuffed as much as I could in my spring 2003 Louis Vuitton Murakami bag. Before I had children or my dogs, that bag was my child. It went everywhere with me. "Is this okay?" I asked the crew. They smiled. "You be you, Jessica." If I was being me, I would have said no to going camping. But I guess they had enough footage of us sitting on the couch, so a camping we will go. The plan was for us to drive to Yosemite National Park with Nick's brother Drew and his wife Leah, who were good wingmen on the show. They were family and I could completely be myself around them, which is to say that Leah and I could sit in the back of the car and commiserate about cramps. My dad decided Nick and I were the 21st century version of I Love Lucy. So early on, the producers were positioning Drew and Leah as our Fred and Ethel. They were there on behalf of the viewers, rolling their eyes at something I said. At least I had the physical comedy of Lucy. I wiped out twice on the hike through Yosemite, though I think that was because I wasn't used to wearing flats. If I were in my 4-inch heels, that would have never happened. We were just a few weeks into filming the show, and in the beginning there was the sense that you always had to be doing something so they could capture it. As Nick did stuff like load the car or cook the burgers, I asked out loud, "Am I supposed to be helping?" Not so much to fulfill my role as a new wife, but to act out my role as a character. It was one giant learning curve, figuring out how to be married and how to create content for a kind of show that had never been done before, something they were calling a reality show. The Osbournes had premiered the previous year and had become the highest-rated show on MTV. As much as the Osbournes showed the real life of a celebrity family, they would have been the first to say it was kind of a circus. My dad pitched Newlyweds to MTV right after the wedding. This would be two celebrities who viewers were used to seeing airbrushed to perfection eating cereal and passing gas. Dad's theory was that this would get me and my music on MTV, who never played my videos unless it was on TRL, while also doing the damage of how I'd been marketed by the label. "If girls knew you, they'd like you," he said. "Columbia's been pushing them all away with the sexy Barbie stuff. This show would be about your heart." He paused a long time, then added, "And Nick." He pitched it to us as a documentary, one that would chronicle our marriage and me working on my third album. If MTV was going to pay me to live my life and be on their channel, it didn't occur to me to say no. Nick was slightly more hesitant, but only slightly. He wanted to start a solo career beyond 98 Degrees and needed to raise his profile. He knew it was tough to be in a boy band as a married man pushing 30. He also knew my dad was going to be a producer in the editing room and would have my back. So Nick's one request was that he wanted to be protected. His manager also got a producer credit, so the show wouldn't be biased against him. Tommy Mottola hated the idea, according to my dad. He told me, "You're going to destroy her career." But after the way my second album had been handled, a Frankenstein of whatever genres Sony thought would sell that day, I didn't put much stock in the label's roadmap to success. There was so little budget for my third album because Tommy, who left Sony in January,
blew through a ton of money on my previous one. Now Don Einar was in charge, and he was not a huge fan. Teresa came back into the picture and told me this was probably the last chance we had with Sony. We made a plan to get back to the natural person that I was, the one that people could relate to. Teresa put me in songwriting camps before writing camps were even a thing that even existed in the industry. She and Casey would get a studio with a bunch of empty office rooms and set them up with tables for writers to meet with me. She paired writers who had never worked together, maybe a country writer and a pop writer, and then put me right in the middle. Some of them thought it was odd to have me there. Teresa recently told me that one guy thought she was crazy. "Does she even write?" he asked her. "I think she can write," she said. "She journals." I wanted to write my own songs. Having realized that since the record company folks had no clue how to position me, I should cut out the middleman and do what felt right to me. I met with Billy Mann, and together we wrote a song called With You, which came from my heart. I wrote it about Nick and how he loved me and made me feel beautiful as I was, with nothing but a t-shirt on. On my own, I started writing lyrics in my journal, including a line about Tommy that would be in the song In This Skin. I know that my talent is real, so don't tell me, I have to be 102, I don't have nothing to prove. I was tired of trying to look perfect, for the church elders and for Columbia. And I brought that to the television show. For 5 months, they filmed us in our natural habitat of Calabasas, putting a camera in the TV and in the corners of the house to supplement the crew walking around with cameras. The crew had to get permission from us whenever we were filmed upstairs. The bedroom and bathrooms were off limits. We could say, "Stop rolling," at any time, but in the beginning, we tried hard not to. They would get to our house at about 8:30 or 9 o'clock and just try to push it so they could stay as late as possible. We would have burn marks on our backs from the mics being strapped to us for so many hours. I was used to the feeling of being watched, having grown up as the pastor's daughter and then Tommy's project at the label. But now we wanted to embrace reality and ourselves as much as possible, even if they would put us into situations just to get a story for the episode. We shot that entire first season that spring and summer, and MTV had us set for an August premiere. They kept having to take breaks when I traveled for work, which was a lot. Throughout that season, I did minimal makeup and let everyone know that yes, I can burp the same volume as my singing voice, which is very, very loud. And you try not to pass gas like crazy when you're on a strict protein diet. A girlfriend who was filming with me came completely done up in full makeup and was surprised when I farted in front of Nick. "Have you heard him?" I said. "Besides, the only thing worth hiding from your man is receipts." I was fine being me and finally finding out who exactly that me was in a very public way. But I did have one blind spot. I wanted my marriage to look perfect. I didn't mind if I looked dumb, but I wanted people to see the fairy tale in Nick, in us. I had the Instagram girlfriend syndrome before it was even a thing, and I wanted the world to see my husband in the best light because I was hopelessly in love with him. But this was a reality show. The camera caught me hanging on his every word and doting on him, but it also caught our struggles. How I would whine and he would get mad at me over stuff that didn't matter. He didn't want me to have a housekeeper come weekly. He hated that we ate out so much, and he didn't want to hire anybody to do home projects. He was frugal, but it wasn't about money. He always wanted to do everything on his own to prove that he could. And he held me to the same standard. Nick wanted me to be a housewife making all the meals, and I admit I went into the marriage hoping to be that way too. I was the girl who registered for everything at Williams-Sonoma thinking I'd be like my mom, but I wasn't even at home to unpack my house, let alone cook meals. For most of my first year of marriage, I was very aware that I was a mid-level celebrity still paying off her wedding and not in a position to say no to any gigs. I would come home, go grocery shopping, and try to be the normal wife Nick wanted, and then leave again. When I returned 2 weeks later, the crew would get us in the kitchen with Nick complaining about the bread that got moldy and the salad that went bad because I bought them 2 weeks before. But if Nick acknowledged how much I was working, he would see that he wasn't, and he was too much of a hard worker to face that head on. The first real fight the cameras caught was about him decorating the house while I was away. It seemed so dumb, but it was about much larger issues in our marriage. I had been away for something like 2 months, and I didn't so much as resent him for decorating without me as I wanted to be able to focus on my career and have a nice home. But I had no time off. To have the home I wanted to give Nick, I needed to bring in professionals to help. Nick didn't want that. I'm sure a lot of women have been caught in that bind of having it all while trying to be all to somebody. Throughout that fight, the closer we got to the real issue, the more frightened I became. I was very aware that the crew was dancing around us, silently getting all the angles. When I get scared, I freeze, so they had to hustle to create a feel of action. When Nick accused me of being a spoiled brat, I knew how to handle that one. I knew I was spoiled, and I was working on that. But then, when he said, "Go away and leave me alone," I slipped. "I am away," I said. "I'm always away." He tipped his head back just slightly, and a realization moved across his face like a storm cloud. "Oh, boo freaking who," he said. "You know what? Sob, sob, sob. Like I'm not doing the same shit you are." "Don't say it, Jessica," I thought. Too real, too real. But it was out of my mouth before I could stop it. I said, "You're not doing half of what I'm doing, baby." "Oh, now we're into this now," he said, reaching for his Miller Lite. "You think you're getting it all figured out." "Baby, I'm not trying to act like I have it all figured out," I said, aborting the mission. I was too afraid of wounding his ego, so I said I would hire him to do stuff and pay him with sex. Talking about our sex life was a classic way to get the crew distracted from some issue. That was always something they seemed to react to and would use to lighten up a plot. I got up and went to the couch to sad watch TV while Nick finished his beer outside. He came to pick me up and carry me to bed. I distinctly remember wondering if someone had told him to. If that was true, it was just too sad. Too real. When the show premiered on August 19th, it was like someone slammed the accelerator on our lives and marriage, pushing it to the highest possible speed. It got huge ratings for MTV, and the standout moment that every late-night comic and news magazine talked about was when Nick and I ate our Atkins-approved chicken of the sea for dinner, watching a game in the living room. "Is this chicken what I have, or is this fish?" I asked. Nick turned his head to stare at me, dumbfounded. "I know it's tuna, but it says chicken," I said. "By the sea. Is that stupid?" The resounding answer across America was yes. My airhead moments, and there was a genuine doozy in each of the first 10 episodes, became known as pulling a Jessica. The show started titling episodes with my gaffes. The platypus for when I thought it was pronounced platymopus. And buffalo wings after the time I told Nick I didn't eat them because they were made from buffalo meat. And yes, these were all legitimate ditzy moments. I didn't care if people made fun of me because we were pulling in nearly 3 million viewers a week. My album, In the Skin, was released the same day as the show premiere and did okay numbers. But sales rose as the show became more and more of a pop culture phenomenon. 2 months later, my single With You was my first number one on the Billboard pop chart. I shot the video at our house, and it highlighted all my gaffes. With You became a TRL staple for months without me having to beg anybody to call in. Handed to my dad because he was absolutely right. People who had dismissed me as a Britney bot now heard me in a different way. Being the butt of the joke ironically gave my music credibility. I was the girl who burped, but hey, did you hear her sing to herself right after? There was no auto-tune in my kitchen. It turned out I had an amazing voice. My record sales got a huge bump from Newlyweds, so when Nick's Soul O album came out in November, everyone expected it to do well, if not better than mine. Instead, it bombed. His debut week, he sold less than 1/10 of what he got his first week on the last 98 Degrees album. He had 2 singles, the second of which was even the theme song to our show, and neither even charted the Billboard Hot 100. Still, we were both getting many offers for appearances and endorsements. We could pick up $100,000 to sing 3 songs at a bar mitzvah, or crazy money to surprise employees at the Chicken of the Sea staff meeting in San Diego. We had once been the also-rans in the music industry, rating vague, "I think I know you" second glances in public, and now we couldn't walk a foot without 5 people coming up to us. The fame was new, but it was also a new kind of fame. Reality television knocked famous people off the pedestal. Girls felt like I had hung out with them in their living rooms, and so when they saw me, they ran up to hug me like we were girlfriends. Couples identified so strongly with us. A man came up to Nick and me early on, pointing to a shy woman at his side who looked nothing like me. "I'm married to a Jessica," he said. "She can say the dumbest things, too." I looked at her and took her hand. Like I do, right? We smiled at each other and laughed. "Yes," she said. It was little moments like that where I was in on the joke and invited others in too that made me feel powerful. MTV signed us for a 2nd season to air in January, with filming set to start on our October 26th anniversary. In the weeks before we went back to work, the media coverage escalated. When Justin Timberlake hosted Saturday Night Live for the first time in October, he put on a blonde wig and shawl to play me trying to defend my intelligence on Saturday Night Live with Jimmy Fallon doing his best Nick. We watched a tape of it together. "Hi, I'm Nick Lachey," said Jimmy, formerly of the band 98 Degrees and currently of, well, nothing. "And I'm his wife, Jessica Simpson," said Justin, formerly of the band Jessica Simpson. He gave me a strange Long Island accent. I turned to Nick. "I don't talk like that, do I?" I asked. "Nah," Nick said. Maybe if he did my actual voice, it would be too close to his then-girlfriend, Brittany. "I know my arms aren't that hairy," I said. I bet he didn't think he'd be playing me someday. A couple days later, we were set to shoot the cover of Rolling Stone. I know Nick saw that as the pinnacle of fame. And then my dad called me. "They just want you on the cover, Jessica," he said, "without Nick." "Oh," I said. I hung up and I remembered the story that Casey had told me when the Newlyweds deal was presented to Sony. Tommy might have hated the idea, but the marketing people loved it because they saw what it did for the Osbournes. Nick was at a different label and one of the Sony guys pointed to the agreement. "I just want everybody to know there's going to be a winner and a loser in this situation," he said. "And let's just hope our girl is the winner." The problem was, if Nick lost, so did I. When we started filming season 2 on our first anniversary, we and the whole crew knew the stakes. Whatever we needed to do to keep the ATM spitting out money would be fine with us. The conceit was that my dad had booked me a gig that would put me in Atlantic City on our anniversary, so Nick would surprise me afterward with a weekend trip to New York City. I was supposed to believe that my husband arranged for rose petals to lead me from the door to the hotel to the bed and then a horse and carriage ride to the tavern on the green. Oh, and he also had the top tier of our wedding cake recreated and sent to the restaurant so we could eat it, a tradition that neither of us had heard of. Nowadays, we all know how much production goes into reality. But back then, people believed. Of course, Nick had nothing to do with any of that, but I wanted people to believe that he was everyone's vision of a leading man. The problem is, Nick could hit his marks, but he couldn't improv any lines. While eating the cake, I asked him what song we were dancing to a year before on our wedding day. When he hemmed and hawed, I tried to help him. "Baby, you don't remember our first dance?" He didn't. I put my head in my hands, not because I was mad at him, but because I was frustrated that he couldn't even act the part MTV handed to him. "It was crazy love," I said quietly. We had become actors in our own lives, playing ourselves. Worse, we slowly started acting out our parts even when cameras weren't rolling. When we did appearances, we didn't want to disappoint people by not doing the whole act. It didn't feel wrong because it was just exaggerated, idealized versions of ourselves. Heck, I wanted to be that happy. Performing as Nick and Jessica became constant because we had 18 or so gigs booked for December alone. We didn't even bother to get a tree, even though MTV would have probably decorated one for us. We went to Ohio to see Nick's family, then my Nana and Papa's house in Waco. Of course, we took the Newlyweds crew along to film every minute. I couldn't hide my sadness in Waco, partly because the holidays always made me miss Sarah, especially when I was with her brother and parents. But I was also starting to feel detached from my real life, and seeing my extended family perform for cameras made me realize how much I was playing a part. Nowadays, I see so many people performing their identities on social media, but I feel like I was a guinea pig for that. How was I supposed to live a real, healthy life filtered through the lens of a reality show? If my personal life was my work, and my work required me to play a certain role, who even was I anymore? I had no idea who I really was. But fame and money are great distractions. When we hosted SNL together in January, timed to the premiere of the second season, my dad told us to think of it as an audition reel for other shows and film studios. We both wanted to do real acting and needed an exit strategy from reality TV, which we knew was about to lose the novelty. My dad came to me with more and more endorsement offers that requested me solo. Unless you're an athlete, it's a girl's world when it comes to selling products. When MTV produced the Super Bowl halftime show in Houston, they invited me to kick off the show without Nick. Just as he was trying to build a solo career, his success became tethered to me. He was proud of my success, but Nick also wanted somebody who could make him feel like I did when I was 19 years old, fawning all over him. I don't think he understood how to have the kind of relationship where I didn't need him to tell me what to do. It was not a happy time for us, and people were no longer satisfied with just seeing us on Newlyweds. The tabloid industry realized we sold covers, and paparazzi began to swarm both of us, especially me. This was before everyone had a phone in their pocket, so the paparazzi industry was incredibly lucrative. You just needed a camera and a willingness to run red lights and chase someone down. As the frenzy built, the camera crew tried to shoot us as they always had, but soon that became impossible. If they arranged for us to sit outside somewhere, people would pull up chairs like they were watching the show. It became impossible to hide. The simplest errand would lead to 8 to 10 cars following me and getting in front of me to block me to get a shot of me with my new Fendi bag. Still, the fame seemed manageable, and then it wasn't. You know the energy you put into huffing and puffing and trying to get out of things? You could have done them 4 times by now. I can't tell you how many times I heard Casey Cobb say that. I built my reputation in the industry for showing up on time on the back of Casey dragging me places. In early 2004, Sony allowed her to keep her A&R job while she became my full-time assistant while Columbia relaunched a deluxe edition of my In the Skin album to capitalize on my new fame. By then, Teresa's artistic leanings weren't valued at Columbia, and she was now over at Jive Records. To help promote the re-release, I was set to do signings in 4 cities around the country. Thanks to the file sharing, the bottom dropped out of the music industry, so the budget was minuscule. Like someone went through the couches at Sony to collect change for me. On March 3rd, Sony flew us to Boston on a red eye and coach because they were too cheap to pay for a hotel. We even did our own hair and makeup in the airport bathroom at Logan until a group of girls realized who I was and started to gather. "I'm a celebrity," I informed Casey for the millionth time. I was joking, but she was there to check me as usual. "Okay, crazy," she said. "Let's just get to the venue." The venue was Walmart. Our driver was a very brusque, older Boston guy who had no idea who I was and didn't care either. I whispered to Casey in the back seat, "Doesn't he think it's kind of weird that he picked us up in the airport and we need to go right to Walmart?" Maybe he thinks we're from corporate, she said. Career girls. We're here to discuss the numbers. A car behind us honked, and I realized we were crawling on the interstate. I've never seen traffic like this, our driver said. There were stretches where cars just weren't moving at all, and Casey began to get anxious. I'm calling them, said Casey. We're going to be so late. But there was no answer at the Walmart. She left a message, and I yelled so they could hear. Don't blame me, I'm trying. Traffic creeped and creeped until we finally got to our exit. Casey seriously wondered if we should just get out and walk. When we got to the parking lot, we saw thousands of people waiting outside. Oh, Lord, I said, what's going on? And then they saw us. We were just in a regular old car with clear windows. News reports said I was in a limo, but trust me, Sony didn't spring for a limo. People rushed to the car, literally climbing on top of each other to see in as our poor driver freaked out. Casey and I scream and drop down to the floorboards. Half in terror, but also with a huge sense of amazement because it finally dawned on us that this wasn't a zombie apocalypse we had stumbled into. It was for me. You're like a beetle, said Casey, and then caught herself. I mean, your version. The Walmart had expected 500 people. 5,000 showed up. Walmart called the police and canceled the event because there was too much of a chance for danger. Jessica Simpson, menace to society. Afterward, we called basically everyone we knew to tell them. The funny thing was that nobody believed us. Well, y'all didn't get out and do it, said my dad, thinking of the 5,000 cells left on the table. What the hell? Dad, they would have to call the National Guard. Three people were arrested that day for disorderly conduct, and another was charged with assault and battery. For the signing in Philadelphia the next day, they had a SWAT team on standby. Walmart went ahead and just canceled the Dallas signing out of fear the hometown girl would draw an even bigger turnout than Boston. I did one more signing at a Tower Records in Los Angeles, wearing jeans in case I had to run. Casey wanted me to wear sneakers, but I refused. The compromise was Louis Vuitton sandals with a lower heel. There was such a huge crowd that in order to accommodate everyone, I had to start signing just my initials. I love you, strangers kept telling me. Aw, I love you too, I'd answer, meaning it. In 1 week, In This Skin jumped from number 16 on the Billboard chart to number 2. Darn you, Norah Jones. That morning, Dad read an industry article to me about the success of the album, making sure to emphasize the part where they credited the well-oiled campaign to roll it out. The sales went up 200%, he said. Do percents go that high? I asked. They do now, he said. I felt like I had won the lottery because as much work as I had put into things, I usually didn't get that kind of return on the investment. There was always still more I needed to do, things I needed to change. Okay, now, next time. But this time, I let myself enjoy the moment. Life was ready to keep me humble, though. On March 14th, I performed for President George Bush at Ford's Theater. And afterward, my dad and I went to the White House for a reception. The room was just stunning, and I kept looking around because I had no idea who anybody was. Someone brought a blondish, gray-haired woman up to me. Hi, I'm Gail Norton, she said. Welcome to the White House. I'm Jessica, I said, shaking her hand. I made a stab at small talk. And what do you do? I'm the Secretary of Interior, she said. Oh my gosh, I said, waving my arm high to take in the room. I love what you have done with the place. Everything is beautiful. My dad pinched my arm and she just walked away. I was trying to be nice and give a compliment, but that's her Jessica Simpson story. Now I know the Secretary of Interior manages federal land and national parks. Believe me, I beat myself up so much over that when I could ace a test on it. At least I had made it to the White House again. I couldn't believe my good fortune. I don't think Nick could either. In countless interviews, people asked him in front of me if he was jealous. Her success is my success, he said again and again, so convincingly that even I almost believed him.